When we asked Chicago Tribune editorial board member Steve Chapman about who the paper would endorse for president this summer, here's the response we got. Would the Chicago Tribune ever endorse a third-party candidate?
I wouldn't rule it out.
And that happened. A surprise endorsement this morning, Libertarian Gary Johnson for president. We'll discuss the decision with one of his editorial board colleagues, Michael Lev. Also, the hard work of diversity. What does it take to make a place truly inclusive? And...
Dance with me. Dance with me.
You know how many people end up missing the one because they're texting?
Do you want to take your coat off and stay a while?
I think I'm okay with my coat on.
Oh, no.
That's a little piece of the trailer for Joe Swanberg's new Netflix series, Easy. The Chicago-based director talks to us about how the characters and the Windy City take center stage. That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for tuning in this Friday, September 30th. This morning, the Chicago Tribune editorial board is the latest newspaper to make a surprise presidential endorsement. But even in this 2016 election season, it may be the most unusual endorsement yet. The Tribune said third-party candidate Gary Johnson would be the best choice for our next president. The editorial board said neither major party represents a principled option, and they pointed to the Libertarian candidate's plan to expand global trade and create jobs. We're joined now by a member of the Chicago Tribune's editorial board, Michael Lev. Michael, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for taking time with us this morning.
Thanks, Nyla.
I think it would have been big news for the Tribune to endorse another Democrat for president, since Barack Obama is the only Democratic presidential candidate the editorial board has ever endorsed. But why endorse a candidate who has little chance of winning?
Because you used that word principled at the beginning, and that's what this is about. I mean, the Tribune has a tradition going back many, many years, 170 years, in which we on the editorial board stand for something. And basically, it would be the idea of kind of maximum personal or individual responsibility and limited government. And so through all those years, we lined up with the Republicans when endorsing for president. And then, as you suggest, we did go the other way with Barack Obama because he was somebody that we knew. So when it came time to look at the endorsement this year, we looked at Donald Trump and rejected his candidacy, and we did that in March. He's not fit to be president, and there was no way that we could endorse him. So then we looked at Hillary Clinton, and her ideas and the things that she stands for just don't align with us.
Right. You said, you all have been pretty clear for some time that you don't think Donald Trump is fit to be president, but you did write Hillary Clinton was, quote, undeniably capable of leading the United States. Why not endorse her?
Because we want to continue to write principled editorials after November 8th. And if we had endorsed Hillary Clinton, then for the next 4 years, and assuming she became president, we'd be saddled with the idea that we supported her for president. And yet so many of the things that she does and stands for are things that we reject. And we really try to play the long game here, where we think about not just what we're trying to say and influence the next day, but also what we're going to say. And so that's why we went with Gary Johnson, because in general, in terms of governing principles and who this person is and what he stands for, it really matches up in a lot of ways with us. Not with every way, but just in the idea of things like trade, things like pushing for jobs, things like trying to get government out of the way, things like being responsible about spending. These are the things that we've always written about. And so when you have a candidate who basically lines up with you, why wouldn't we do it? Well, the reason would be because we're trying to kind of play the angles and say, don't vote for Trump. We don't really believe in Hillary Clinton, but we're going to support her because we want you to vote for her because we want her to be president. It just gets into playing a political game that we don't want to do. We would much rather stand for an idea.
When we think about that, the idea of you standing for an idea, that makes sense. You're saying basically line up with Gary Johnson. I can't help but think of the flubs that we've seen from him this week. He said he was having another, quote, Aleppo moment when he, again, couldn't name the former Mexican president or his world leader. That Aleppo moment, of course, is him referring to a time when he was confused by hearing the name of the Syrian town of Aleppo. Mm-hmm. Do you feel like he's capable to lead the United States?
Yeah, we do. And I wish he hadn't made that mistake. But all candidates make mistakes. They make gaffes. They say dumb things. And even in our criticisms of Trump, we tried to level them in a way in which we were relating to the things that he would do, not everything that he said. We could have written an editorial every day about the dumb, irresponsible, and offensive thing he said, and we just don't. That's not how we look at things. I mean, more broadly, some of his ideas about isolationism we also reject. But when we met with him and he came to see us, we also saw that he was a pragmatist too, and we were perfectly comfortable with the idea that if he became president with William Weld as vice president, that they would run the country responsibly, and we were comfortable with that, and so that allowed us then to make the principal decision that we made.
And you all reject, you wrote, we reject the cliche that a citizen who chooses a third party candidate is, quote, squandering his or her vote. President Obama said this week that a vote for a third party candidate who has no chance to win is a vote for Trump. So I wonder how much of did you think about Illinois, how much Illinois is polling right now, and whether the state will go for Hillary regardless? Did that factor into your thinking? Or
well, yes and no. I think there are differences of opinion about what those votes for Johnson would otherwise where they would go. But it really isn't about that. It really is about sort of who Johnson is. And, you know, if anything, beyond the idea of endorsing Johnson, it's a repudiation of where the politics of the country is overall. And if we can get attention for that, we are frustrated with the Republican Party and where it's gone. And we're just as frustrated with the Democrats, and particularly with this pull left. If you look at the polls, more than 50% of voters agree with us. They didn't like either of these candidates. I mean, literally, they don't like either of these candidates, and we're with them. And if you don't like that, what do? You try to change the system. And that's what this is an endorsement of, changing the system.
Michael Lev is a member of the Chicago Tribune editorial board. Michael, I know we have to let you go. I know you've been doing a lot of different interviews this morning. Thanks for taking the time to join us. We appreciate it.
I appreciate it. Bye-bye.
We hear so much about why diversity is important and how many workplaces, organizations, and others value the concept. But, you know, we don't talk about how hard diversity can be to implement. And that's something that Emily Knox not just thinks about, but does. As a member of Makerspace Urbana, where they've tried to intentionally create a diverse, inclusive space. We wanted to spend a few minutes talking about that now on the 21st with Emily, who's in studio with me, as well as Lorraine Bryson, who's the president and CEO of the Tri-County Urban League in Peoria and on the line from there. Lorraine, Emily, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you so much.
Emily, I wanted to start with you. You've said that when you were asked to first get involved with Makerspace Urbana, you were hesitant at first. Why is that?
I was hesitant because I didn't really make much. I had heard about makerspaces, but I'd never been in one. And I associated them a lot with people sitting at computers and coding things or doing small electronics, or people who already knew how to make things. And I didn't really know how to make anything.
And Emily, we were inspired to kind of talk to you by a talk that you gave recently. And you quoted Verna Myers, a nationally recognized expert on diversity inclusion in the field of law, who said, diversity is being invited to the party. Inclusion is being asked to dance. How does this notion of being inclusive, being asked to dance at the party, how do you all put that into action at Makerspace Urbana?
So we work on it every day at Makerspace Urbana. I was just talking to a friend about this yesterday, and we work hard to make our space welcoming to everybody. One way we do that is by setting up the space itself so that's welcoming. We have a welcome desk, and that invites you to sign our guest book. And then the space itself has empty tables that look like you can do whatever you would like at those tables. We also always have a sewing machine out to show that we are not just gendered male in our space. Like, we want people to engage in the so-called soft arts, right? So we always have knitting needles, a sewing machine, along with our 3D printer, our vinyl cutter. And also the members themselves work on being inviting to whoever stops by. So showing them around the space, talking to them about the space. This actually takes much more work than it seems like it would, because I myself am a sort of introverted person. So I have to remind myself that when someone new comes in, that I need to
physically go over them and talk to them.
Yes.
And is that something also, so Makerspace, as you're describing it, isn't just a space to create technology. Mm-hmm. It's a creative space where you want people to be making things. within a culture of that, do you feel like you have to be very intentional with people who are in leadership in that space to say, if we're going to create a culture of being welcoming, we have to do things like walk up to people and invite them in?
Yes. And we constantly have to remember everybody who is a key member. So key member so it means that we have 24/7 access to the space, that when someone new comes in, that you need to walk over to them. We also encourage people, like they'll come in and say, well, I don't know how to do so and so. And we say, anybody here can teach you how to do it. So we often teach people how to solder. And almost all of us who are regular members can teach someone how to solder in about 10 minutes. And it's a really easy way to engage someone and actually also show them they can make something very quickly. And once you learn how to do one thing, it can open up doors to doing other things.
Emily, how much is Makerspace interested in having women or other underrepresented groups interested in the science, technology, engineering, math fields? Or is it more so about giving everyone a creative space apart from sort of the STEM fields?
So this is a major discussion within the maker movement as a whole across the country. I was recently invited to the Nation of Makers at the White House. And the chief technology officer of the United States told us it was the least gendered, the most gendered room she had been in a long time. It was mostly male. And she said, this is a problem. And not just for technology, but also thinking about how can we combine arts and technology. So rather than thinking about just STEM, one of my favorite things to think about is STEAM, which includes arts within science, technology, engineering, and math. And that's really what we're dedicated to at Makerspace Urbana, is all sorts of making. And we love to combine tech and art. So we often do things like needlework that will light up. So you use conductive thread in it, and you put some LEDs on your needle point, and you can put lights in it. And that's just one way of combining, a simple way of combining arts and technology.
Well, and back to that event at the White House, you were also one of the few women of color in the room,
yes.
Maybe one of the few people of color within this
yes.
room. And I wonder, that's a really tough space to be in also.
It is. I mean, you definitely feel you are always aware when you are one of the few people of color in a room. But I felt it was important for me to be there because if we're not intentional about inclusivity, and I'm also willing to take that on, like to be one of the few people of color in a room. And I want people who are there to realize that, well, maybe we aren't reaching out if we look at the numbers just themselves, you know. And I felt it was really great that the chief technology officer called us out on it, right? And it wasn't in a, like, hectoring way. It was just, look around, everybody. What do you see? And we can't move forward as a country if we don't include everybody in these new ways of thinking about the world.
That's Emily Knox, a key member of Makerspace Urbana. I want to bring Lorraine Bryson into the conversation as well. Lorraine, last time you were on the program, we were talking about the Girls Who Code program you want to start with the Tri-County Urban League in Peoria. And you talked about how the organization made the Power Girls group to give girls a chance to learn about computers. I wonder, in your opinion, what do you think it takes as an organization to, Emily's been sharing about how they're trying to promote diversity and inclusiveness. What do you think? How do you think this can be done well?
Well, I think it takes a commitment from the top, first of all. The leadership has to not only be about diversity and, you know, awareness of diversity, but really value diversity, and inclusion is kind of along the continuum. You have to be aware first before you can get to the point where you value it and then you put it into action. And we as a society have to move to the point where we appreciate diversity and the value of different opinions and how that makes us stronger as an organization, a community, as well as a nation. Going about that, you know, you have to reach out. You have to include people in the workplace, those who make those decisions. You have to give them training so that they can also appreciate and not just want to do it because they're forced to do it, but really appreciate the value of having different opinions. I think that, you know, Emily has already talked about some prime examples of how they have worked to be inclusive and have an inclusive space. And that can be kind of synonymous, in my opinion, to retention. Even after you hire someone and bring them into your workplace, in order to retain them, they have to feel comfortable enough in that workplace to want to stay. So those are just some of the things that we need to think about as employers and as society on how we can value diversity and improve our product and what we do by the diversity of ideas.
We just got about a minute before we take a break, but I wanted to ask you, Lorraine, really quickly, how hard do you think it is to recruit someone to work somewhere if they feel like they're not properly represented, if they feel like they're the only person that looks like them in the room?
Well, I think that first person is the most difficult, but once you get one person in, it's incumbent to stay on track and to keep adding people because, as I said, if they feel isolated, they're not going to stay. They're going to go to an environment where they are welcomed.
When we come back, we're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Lorraine Bryson. You just heard her. She's the president and CEO of the Tri-County Urban League in Peoria, talking to us about Girls Who Code, talking to us about diversity and inclusion. Emily Knox is with us as well. I want to get to the really nitty-gritty of this, the challenges of this, how hard it is, right? Because I think the conversation we've just had is one that a lot of people have about why it's important. But when we come back, we're going to figure out, we're going to hear examples of how hard this is and how actually these organizations are working through it. You're listening to The 21st. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. We're talking about diversity and inclusion, buzzwords we hear very often today, but we're talking about the work of doing it, the challenges that are there. We have two examples of organizations who are making this intentional and how they are working through this. In studio with me in Urbana is Emily Knox. She's a key member of Makerspace Urbana. On the line with us from Peoria is Lorraine Bryson. She's president and CEO of the Tri-County Urban League, also working on starting a Girls Who Code initiative. Lorraine, you know, you said the hardest part of this is getting that first person into the organization. And when you have an organization where there's that only one person or a very small number of an underrepresented group, what can other people do there to make sure that those people feel supported and want to stay?
Well, that's where the inclusion comes into play. Including them in activities, trying to find common interests, making it a welcoming space, making sure that that person is valued and respected as opposed to a cold environment where they're not really a part of the group. And I think that, you know, once again, the difficulty is probably not as difficult as we make it out to be. It makes me think of a saying my mother used to always tell me, you can do anything you put your mind to. And it goes back, I believe, to the leadership. If the leadership values that and wants that to happen in the organization, then everyone else will tend to fall in line.
Emily, what about you? What do you think makes this a difficult? What I wonder how you guys have dealt with this at Makerspace in terms of if it is, you know, as Lorraine's talking about, it is a simple thing, but perhaps it's not an easy thing.
So it's simple because what comes up is that you have to communicate. But of course, communication is difficult through conflict. So we've had conflicts come up among our members. And actually thinking about what to do next once that conflict comes up in the air is actually the difficult part. Because what you realize you'll have to do is put those two people together to talk to each other. And getting through those conversations can be difficult, even physically. It causes anxiety and stress. You know, your heart rate will start rising. We had a long conversation in one of our membership meetings about race and various things going on in the community. And just going through that conversation with people, making sure that everybody understands what where everybody is coming from, you have to kind of put your cards out on the table. And that can be uncomfortable to do, but you can't move to the next level unless you get through that conversation. And it also involves trust. So you have to trust that the people that you're talking to will hear you. And it's worth it to do a follow-up after you've gotten through that conversation to say, you know, I'm really glad you heard me. We might not all agree on whatever the outcome of this conversation was, but it's important to be able to say, you know, I'm glad that we had the conversation in the first place.
And Emily, I think you all have, it sounds like at Makerspace Urbana, it's not a hierarchy. It's not a workplace. It's a place where people are coming together voluntarily. Mm-hmm. And I think that probably makes a little bit of a difference when we're thinking about, Lorraine, I can't help but think about how this might work in a workplace. And I wonder, you said that you think leadership has to be on board. What other challenges do you see to having these cultural shifts that we're talking about in workspaces?
I think having that direction, because if all the employees in the organization don't see that it's important value, then they may not be as willing to come along. And you can kind of impose, or not necessarily impose, but kind of spread around that value and that change by various different incentives, and more importantly, by the first line of contact. So whoever that new employee is that comes into the workplace, their supervisor, that one-on-one relationship that they're able to build, that kind of builds that trust. And once that trust begins to build, then the person's feelings of inclusiveness, I think, increase. And as it begins with their supervisor, then it can pass on. So not only are you doing it from the top down in terms of this is the culture we want to have, but then you're also building it from the bottom up, from that new employee to their supervision and all the way up the line of the organization. And so when the two intersect, then your culture has been changed.
Do you have examples of places you think that have done this well? And you don't have to name names. It's fine if you want to just share a story.
Well, I think that, ironically, some of the tech companies, probably the larger ones, have done a good job of having inclusive environments and some diversity of ideas and different people. I just think of some statistics that I've heard of the best place to work and those kinds of things. I mean, they have created a culture that is welcoming to differences of opinion. But I think it all begins one-on-one with, as Emily has pointed out, that communication and building trust, and that trust then develops into the values that have been set out by the leadership.
Emily, I know that as we are wrapping up, we just have about a minute or two left. I know tomorrow you guys have a Heartland Maker Fest. Mm-hmm. I wonder if you can tell us a little bit about that event and any sort of final words about how you think that this can be, people can kind of move easier into this space.
So the Heartland Maker Fest is tomorrow at Lincoln Square Mall between 9 a.m. and 2 p.m. It's a free event. It is kid friendly, and we believe that it really embodies our mission and ethos of Makerspace Urbana. So you'll see...
Why is that?
You'll see lots of different makers there. So there'll be people who are painters. There'll be people who make puppets. There'll be people who will teach soldering at our own at Makerspace Urbana's table. We'll also have an obstacle course, so you can bring your drone if you'd like to do that. And it's our biggest event of the year. Last year we had about 2,700 people come through. We have 30 makers this year, and it's just a way to show all the different diverse makers in our community.
That's Emily Knox. We'll tweet out that information for folks who are in the Champaign-Urbana area. If you follow 21st Show, we'll have it up on our website also, 21stshow.org. I want to thank Emily Knox with Makerspace Urbana. Also want to thank Lorraine Bryson, President and CEO of the Tri-County Urban League in Peoria. Ladies, thank you for taking time to talk with me about this.
You're welcome.
Thanks so much.
I'm Nyla Boodoo. You're listening to The 21st.
So I was at this party last night, and some guy brought that for us to taste, and it's pretty good.
Huh?
But what made it interesting to me was he was telling us that apparently it's some kind of underground brewery, which is something I'd never heard of before, and that it's illegal.
You want to bust up their operation, and then you're going to start your own brewery? I work for you. Let's do it.
No. I think there's a story, and I'd like you to try to get inside it and tell the story.
Okay. I'll get on it.
All right.
Yep.
Chicago-based indie movie director Joe Swanberg is trying his hand at a shorter form that's a scene from his new Netflix series, Easy. The 8-episode series, which tells very different stories about relationships, sex, and love, dropped last week. It was shot and filmed in Chicago, and I would say my favorite character in this series is the city of Chicago. The series features many of its local sights, sounds, and people. As you just heard, that was Chicago native Hannibal Buress, who's in that episode, aptly titled Hop Dreams. The creator, producer, writer, director of the series, Joe Swanberg, is with us now. Hey, Joe, welcome to the 21st. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
I should say to our audience, I know a bit about this more than your other work because I was a cameo in one of your episodes. I feel like everyone should know that if they haven't seen it. I play myself, but it's been fun for me to hear people all over talking about this. And I want to start with a name, because I remember the conversation you and I had last fall when you were shooting this, because we were both working on launching new things. I was working on the show and you the series. And do you remember the conversation I had with you about this, about naming my show The 21st? How did, and you were talking about how you didn't have a name yet for this series.
Yeah. It was very stressful. I mean, we went through all of production trying on, 15 or 20 different titles. I would sit with one, we would shoot an episode, I would go, no, that's not the right name now that we shot this episode. Always searching for something that felt all-encompassing and open and a title that could let the show grow and be what it wanted to become, but also something that felt connected to the material. And
that's how you came up with Easy.
It was hard.
Yeah.
Easy was, we had finished shooting the entire thing, I believe, before Easy finally landed. And it was interesting after auditioning. I don't know how many people you auditioned your title to, but I was asking around, and there were three or four contenders that we were kind of kicking around, and I would end up in conversations with people and I would say, what do you think about this? What do you think about this? And it was interesting when Easy kind of entered the picture. The answer was kind of resoundingly like, oh yeah, that's good. I like that. I don't think anybody was like, yes, that is the best title ever. But it was consistently something that worked for people and also really worked for me, because I love the kind of sexual connotations of Easy. I feel like they fit nicely with the show, but I also think that the word is really pretty to look at. It's nice to say, and I think that it doesn't have only sexual connotations, because while this show is definitely about sex,
right, this is definitely an adult show, we should say. This
is
not for children. Right. And now, all of these are also individual stories. Why did you want to have a television, I guess we call it television series, it's so weird to say that when it's on Netflix, but why did you,
changing, right?
Well, there should be another name for this.
Do we even call it TV anymore?
Well, that's why I just said Netflix series, right? So, but why, they're not episodic, they're all self-contained. Why did you want to do that?
That's right. Well, I was afraid of TV, honestly. A lot of my friends have done TV shows. Because of the rate that I work at, I've made a lot of movies over a short period of time. People were always kind of like, why aren't you working in TV? It's so fast. You would love it. And I was, you know, I had never, with all the movies, had characters that I thought I would want to spend more than a little bit of time with. And as I watched friends of mine create TV shows, especially the successful ones that were able to move into multiple seasons, I was kind of like, oh, gosh.
It's a lot of commitment, right?
The same four characters, the same three characters. You know, it's like, and also, you know, these conventions of TV mean that sometimes you're inherently trapped in a dynamic. Like, there are shows that start out with characters in their mid-20s who all live together in an apartment or something like that. Well, if the show does really well and runs for 8 years, often they are still living together in that apartment. And you're like, what is going on here? Like, why are these people in their 30s all still living together? And the show has to keep inventing reasons why they're sort of stuck in this permanent place. And so I really wanted to make a show that felt like it could go back to any of these characters, but it didn't have to. And, you know, my interests change a lot. I was sort of like, how do I come up with a format that will allow the show to always be about what I'm interested in at any given time, whether it's political, sexual, whether it revolves around business, whether it revolves around people's home lives. Easy feels wide open to me, like it could go anywhere over the next couple of years.
And this season is definitely about sex and relationships and marriage. So what brought you there? Why did you decide? I mean, this is pretty different. I'm thinking about Drinking Buddies or Happy Christmas. This is a totally different realm, I feel like.
I totally agree. I mean, I think that it's definitely the most relationship focused and sex focused of any of the recent work. And I think, I mean, I certainly found myself again and again in conversations with actors where questioning the status quo of, you know, like marriage and monogamy and things like that were, without me steering that direction, you know, kind of kept coming up. And so, you know, I knew something was brewing as of a few years ago where I was like, wow, why is this constantly a topic of conversation? And why do people feel so frustrated and sort of unfulfilled by the conventional version of, you know, kind of growing up, meeting somebody, marrying that person and having a family? And so, you know, that was kind of kicking around in my head a lot. And I think with the anthology format, each time these characters and relationships started to congeal for me, you know, it's sort of like, that's what I wanted to know about, you know, how are these characters relating to each other, not just in their kind of like interpersonal or work lives, but in their sexual lives. And so, you know, without meaning to, I didn't even start shooting the series thinking that it was going to be so sex heavy, but because of the way I work, where the actors are improvising, where we're kind of building these narratives together, once again, it kind of kept going there. And I was happy to let it, you know, sort of like let that zeitgeist lead the way.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to continue this conversation with Joe Swanberg, Chicago director. His Netflix series Easy just dropped. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Nyla Boodoo. My guest is Joe Swanberg. He's a director. He's a creator behind his first foray into the short-form television world. Actually, it's Netflix. The series is called Easy. It's an 8-episode first season. Just dropped last week on Netflix, and it's all about Chicago. We've been talking about relationships and sex and all of the different things that are all... And we're no spoilers here, because I know, Joe, people were really, they said, I don't want you to spoil this. And I was like, we can't really spoil it, because every episode is its own thing. So I won't spoil it for people, because I know a lot of people are still watching it. But I wonder if I can, when you and I, this cameo that I did for episode 5 that I was in with you, the way that the process that you work is, I didn't get a script. You know, we talked through what you wanted me to do. Can you sort of explain your process of how you shoot and how you do that and how that was to do that in a television series as opposed to how you've done this previously for movies?
Absolutely. I mean, I should say one of the reasons why television seemed so unapproachable to me was because of how I work. It is very rare to find a partner like Netflix who would let me make a TV show where I could not tell them before we started shooting an episode what would happen.
Right. You didn't want to give, you're like, I can't give you a script because I don't have one.
I can't. I don't know what's going to happen. So the way I work is I tend to cast first. So we started each of these 8 episodes with an outline, really an idea. I would say like a paragraph with a very brief description of central character and some theme or point of conflict. And then I went about finding the actors. And then, you know, once I find the actors, and even, you know, in your case, when I came to you and said, Nyla, I would love for you to play yourself in this, what I basically say is, here's what I think this scene is about. Here's what I know about these characters. But, you know, when you and Mark Maron did the scene, I think we did 3 takes.
We did 3 takes, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you know, all 3 of those takes were different. You were really interviewing him each time. He was answering some of the questions in the same way, but also inventing on the spot and honestly building backstory on the spot, because we shot your interview with him very early in the shooting of that episode because I wanted to learn from it. I wanted to hear what he said and how he answered those questions so that we could move forward with shooting other scenes and building that story. And that's pretty typical. I mean, I have a kind of beginning, middle, and end when we start, but I would say that that's up for grabs. And if the shooting of one scene were to suddenly introduce some new information that was not part of that outline, I try and work in such a way that it's flexible and that new information could inform other things that we shoot. And so, you know, the idea is that we do it as chronologically as possible. Sometimes due to locations and things like that, we can't do it totally chronologically. But, it's always built around the idea of letting the actors bring as much of themselves as they're willing to bring and trying to find these nice pairings in which people can act but are not, are sort of asked to act very naturalistically and not so far outside of normal experiences. Say, even though you've interviewed a lot of people, I also was asking you to perform. You know, you sort of are really interviewing Mark, but
I sort of wasn't. Was it? It was definitely an odd space for me, for sure. Yeah.
I needed some things from you. Needed some performance things from you. And so the idea is to kind of like marry those worlds where it feels very organic, but also the performance you're giving is hiding behind the kind of naturalism.
And so there's this entire episode, Joe, that's in Spanish. Did you improvise that? How did you do that?
Yes. Well, we would improvise and then the actors would translate for me what they just improvised. And they all spoke English. And so all of the pre-production of that episode was happening in English, but we knew we were going to do it in Spanish. I mean, it was important for me. You know, we shot and set that episode in Pilsen. And also, you know, in terms of representation of the city, we have a huge Spanish-speaking contingent and, you know, especially a Mexican contingent to this city that really, for me is a big and important part of what Chicago is. And so I was working with Mexican actors and it was really fun, honestly. I mean, I speak some Spanish. Definitely, I'm not fluent. And a lot of what was happening on camera did require a big conversation afterwards. But what I found was that even though I could not follow along word for word, you still know when a take feels right versus when it needs some work. And
well, that's interesting. Even when it's in another language, you knew we have it or we don't have it. Okay.
Chemistry is chemistry. And, you know, the sort of like timing and dramatic arc of these things was totally recognizable to me. And, you know, I'm willing to bet that if people turned their subtitles off and just watched that episode, they would be surprised how much they could follow along as well. And in many ways, that episode liberated me visually because the nuance of language and the way people communicate is such a big part of the work and what I'm interested in. And because I literally could not be focused on that or micromanage about that, I found myself able to think visually in a different kind of way and think about the shots in a different kind of way. And that ends up being one of my favorite episodes of the season because it really does feel different and exciting to me.
Yeah, that was one of my favorite episodes too. And I think partially because there's also this beautiful scene of Chicago when they're downtown and they're walking. They go to Millennium Park and they're walking over the bridge. And
yeah.
How did you, I wonder, there is such a, there's so much of Chicago in this. And I wanted to ask, first of all, how did you pick locations to shoot? Because you had eight, as you mentioned, that episode was focused in Pilsen. How did you mm-hmm. pick what neighborhoods you wanted to focus on?
Well, I thought about the characters first. I mean, it's, you know, it's pretty north side centric. You know, Pilsen is the farthest south we go mm-hmm. this season. So, you know, I'm being informed by places that I go. It's certainly easier for me to write for characters who I know better. And because I live on the north side, in terms of this series and where I hope Easy could go over the next several years, season one felt to me like chapter one, you know, just kind of like the very beginning of telling what I hope will be a really long-term story and what I hope will be a really, like, very wide-ranging Chicago story. And so diving into it, first and foremost, I wanted to get it right. I mean, I wanted to represent everywhere we shot in a way that felt realistic to the characters, the socioeconomic demographics, like everything. I wouldn't have any excuses to like miss things like that.
Well, and you know, everyone in Chicago will also tear you apart if you don't.
Oh, my gosh. Of course.
<It's>, I mean, that's Chicago, right? And I'm going to get to that in a minute because there's been like this incredible on my Facebook page conversation that's been raging about Easy that I want to get to in a second. But I wanted to ask you first about the local people who are in this, because you see a lot of local actors who people in the Chicago theater scene will recognize. Why is it? Was it really important for you to also have local actors that also starred in this?
Absolutely. And I would say that, you know, fingers crossed, if we can do more seasons of the show, you would see more and more local actors, because it's really, I mean, not only are they dressing the part, talking the part, and feeling authentic in a way that matters to me, but, you know, additionally, the way this show is structured and with the improv and everything else, when I bring an actor in from Los Angeles or New York, I really only have 4 or 5 days with that actor. But, you know, the more that I can work with local actors, the more the show takes on a kind of flexibility where I can call somebody when new ideas emerge out of the improv and say, hey, you know, this scene was not written into the episode, but what are you doing on Thursday? Can you come shoot a new scene? So, you know, I would say that as the show evolves, it will merge more towards developing and using actors who are based here in Chicago. The only fear I have is that all of the great actors came out of Chicago and then they all left.
Well, think about Hannibal Buress, right? Did you guys, by the way, both of you were graduates of Southern Illinois in Carbondale, right? Did you guys
think?
Did
we were there.
I was going to ask, were you there at the same time?
Yeah.
Okay.
We absolutely were, and we did not know each other other than it's entirely possible I saw him do comedy while I was at school and just did not know who he was.
And so I want to get to, it's fascinating to me how many people in Chicago are having these arguments on Facebook and everywhere, like, is this Chicago? And, you know, the comments like, people in Chicago don't have this much sex and drink this much Half Acre. And they also don't look like Orlando Bloom, who also stars in this. But what did you want to say for this first season, as you said, about the North Side? Like, what did you want to say about Chicago in this?
Well, I would say that it is and it isn't Chicago. It certainly is set here. It's created by a lot of people who live here. You know, we knew what we were doing. We knew where we were filming, what it was supposed to look like. But, you know, I would never dream of calling the show representative of the city as a whole. And so I think with season one, we got certain pieces of the city right. I think with season two, we'll expand to include more neighborhoods. I would make this show for the next 25 years if I could. And, you know, so I would say that we're moving towards a broader canvas and something that I would feel more comfortable calling a representation of Chicago. But I also think it would be incorrect to say that it isn't Chicago, because it certainly is very kind of like location specific and accurate to these pockets. And, you know, we're not bending geography. And we're not doing things that a lot of shows do where somebody
like on Shameless
the
when they walk out of the South Side and then all of a sudden and they're on a bus in the North Suburbs. And I'm just like, what happened there? You know,
like my characters live in real neighborhoods and go to the restaurants in those neighborhoods.
Right.
You know, kind of inhabit spaces that you could realistically inhabit yourself.
And I can't help but think, Joe, because I was watching it this week and I was finishing up the episodes this week and it was right after the presidential debates. And I was thinking about what Donald Trump's comments about Chicago and comparing that with lots of what we see sort of in the negative press that Chicago is getting right now and the international images of Chicago. I mean, did you think about that when you were putting this together also, sort of what people outside of Chicago tend to think of it?
Yeah, not so much. I mean, I'm kind of... it's interesting. You know, we started working on the show in September of last year. So it's been almost a year since we started shooting the first episodes. And, you know, the violence in the city has gotten so much more media attention over the last year than I felt like it was getting a year
ago.
That's
true. Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, in many ways, I'm really happy to be putting out representation of Chicago that's not entirely focused on that. You know, Spike Lee came here and made Chirac, and there's been, you know, we have all the Dick Wolf, Chicago Fire and Police and all those kinds of shows. But, you know, I don't think people get to see more relaxed, neighborhoody, fun view of Chicago all that often in the media. And so it was not a kind of political intention going in, though now that the show you know, has finally come out, I do feel good that there's this alternative representation of the city that to me is not soft selling or underplaying any of the violence or gang activity or anything like that. But what it is saying is that this is a big complicated city, and that stuff is not affecting everybody in the same way. And that, you know, I mean, it's gotten to the point where when I travel around and tell people I'm from Chicago, they get a look on their face,
right? Mm-hmm.
And they're like, Chicago's really dangerous, right? And I'm like, no, it's not like you walk down the street and everywhere you go people are getting murdered. You know, there is like a massive city in which a lot of that violence is taking place in these really small pockets and not affecting people's lives in some cases at all. You know, I mean, I personally care and pay attention to that. And so, you know, it's sort of like very present in my own view of the city. But, you know, if you weren't reading the news and living in Chicago, you could be going about your life, you know, for the past several years, not even aware that that's happening. It's very, unfortunately, segregated. And mm-hmm. it is really interesting these days to be a Chicagoan in other cities. But, you know, it's mostly interesting to me because of how inaccurate the representation seems to be.
That said, you've mentioned season two. Is there going to be a season two? Do we know?
We do not know. I wish I could say yes right now. This is also new for me. You know, typically I finish a movie and then the movie comes
You're
out.
You're done, right.
And I'm done. And this is the first time where I'm sitting here anxiously awaiting news of whether I get to do this more or not. I'm optimistic. I feel like the show is finding a nice big audience, actually a much broader and more diverse audience than I expected. And certainly critically and in terms of viewership, it's doing much better than any movie I've made before. So I certainly feel positive that we have a good shot at a season two, but this is not confirmed yet.
Well, season one is out now. It's called Easy. It's on Netflix. Joe, thanks so much. Joe Swanberg, thanks for speaking to me.
Yeah, it was great to talk.
All right.
And thanks for being in the show.
Yeah.
I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. That does it for us today. We're produced by Christine Herman, Philip Kisabika, and Sean Newman. Technical direction comes from Steve Mork. Scott Cameron is our news director. Joe Yoon and Nick Vance from the University of Illinois Social Media Analytics Lab provide research help. Special thanks to the band Public Access for our theme music. You can always find past shows on the NPR One app. Search for The 21st. We're also available on iTunes and Android. I'm Nyla Boodoo. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.